baby, can't you see I'm calling? A guy like you should wear a warning. It's dangerous, I'm falling.
Welcome, Wisconsin. My name is Maggie Dawn. You are listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. If you're just joining us, we've been having an in-depth conversation with Dr. Robin DiAngelo, a professor, a prominent author, an educator from the University of Washington, who has over two decades of experience in diversity training, racial awareness, and social justice. She's written two groundbreaking books, White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism, and more recently, Nice Racism, How Progressive White People Perpetuate Social Harm. Again, thank you for your time. Very generous of you, Dr. DiAngelo. I know you're in high demand, especially in this moment where we see almost every day some new sort of anti-woke, anti-DEI legislation percolating up, basically trying to keep any discussion of race out of classrooms, which just seems stupid and very intentionally harmful, ultimately harmful to white students and children, but more directly and immediately and acutely harmful to black and brown children. What message are we sending? What should people say or do in reaction if they're seeing legislation like this in their communities?
Yeah, and there's so much there. And I actually appreciate that you acknowledge that, there's loss, a different kind of loss, in a white people not getting educated, in us not seeing the full humanity of our fellow citizens and so forth. But I want to reinforce one more piece, because I really, that sense of humility is so important, because we're going to end with, where do we go from here? And if we don't start with a sense of, I am part of the problem, I'm not sure how, but I am, and I'm on the journey to find out. If we don't start there, you know, I don't think we're going to get where we need to go. So I want you to imagine that most white people were taught by white people who 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 were taught by white people, who were taught by white people, using textbooks for, by, and about white people. And I just want you to feel that kind of the weight of the whiteness of that. You have a worldview. It is not neutral. It is not objective. We were told that they have racial bias and we're neutral and objective. And if I can convey anything, it's that you just are not. and again, I hope you're inspired to kind of unpack how. So to deny, right, to actually, in a way, we can say we have put white fragility into law, right? It is illegal to cause anyone to feel any discomfort. Okay, so the status quo of our society is racism. By every measure, across every institution, it is reproduced. And as a white person, I live, love, work, play, move every day through a racist society in racial comfort. And to be out of my racial comfort, let's be honest, that's a choice I have. That's one of the things we call a privilege. Yes. I can easily avoid ever being racially uncomfortable. So we're not going to get where we want to go by maintaining white racial comfort. You have to see the discomfort as a sign of movement. You want the discomfort. You don't think about anything hard in your life that was profoundly changing for you, that you learned from. It wasn't when things were going great for you, right? It's from the hard stuff, right? The challenges. So people like me who've been spending decades, and all the people before me for centuries, who've been trying to get into the mainstream, this understanding of systemic racism, right? Not the good, bad, simple formula, but it's a system. White supremacy is not people just in hoods. It's the concept that white people are the norm for what it means to be human, are the standard for humanity, and every hue away from that is less human, and so forth. Finally, these concepts got into the mainstream in 2020, right? With the racial reckoning and the Black Lives Matter movement and George Floyd. And in just 4 years, look how swiftly it's been crushed. So it is literally illegal in at least 17 states, last time I counted, to teach this history in public schools. And I think if Project 2025 comes in, it will be federally illegal. That's one, how threatening that racial reckoning was, but also how powerful the forces are. It's an incredibly adaptive system.
Yes.
And we cannot be complacent and think, oh, do you know how many people said when Obama was president?
Oh, yeah, racism is over.
And I would argue that the Trump years and what we have seen is a reaction.
Is a reaction.
It so wasn't over. Yeah. And Trump gave permission to be blatantly, yes, openly, explicitly racist. So, yeah, we definitely need to resist. I can offer you different organizations and resources that can help, but I'll pause that and see where you want it to take me.
Please, we're going to end with those resources. Can't leave people hanging without that. Very briefly, okay. Dr. D'Angelo, would you be willing to share sometime when you were racist and how you dealt with that and how you engaged with the person that you harmed in that way so that people can feel like, hey, this isn't just all words. This happens. Here's how we do better. Any example that you feel comfortable sharing?
Sure. This is an example I actually write about at the end of White Fragility, but I was in a work meeting. I was the only white person in the room. The other two people were on my team because we were the DIE folks. And we had a meeting with a new tech person who was a black woman. And I, you know, got real relaxed and, you know, because I had a relationship with these other two women. And I was pretty flippant in there and I was kind of dismissive. I mean, I wasn't consciously, but I looked, you know, after I got the feedback and this tech person who was a consultant who had come in to meet with us had this survey. And I was like, oh, this thing doesn't speak to what we do. Let me tell you what we do. I was just very arrogant. And it came back to me that she was actually found me to be a bit of a jerk. We can't use any swear words. And of course, fortunately, I immediately recognized my behavior. There were jokes that I made, and you know, I worked through my feelings with another white friend because, of course, I was mortified, and I felt, you know, I didn't really feel defensive, thank goodness, but I needed to get out some of that immediate anxiety so that I could make a repair from a place that wasn't trying to get her to make me feel better. Mm-hmm. Cause that's what we often do. So I kind of vented some of that with another white friend, got clear. And then I picked up the phone and I called her. And this is exactly what I said. Would you be willing to grant me the opportunity to repair the racism that I perpetrated in the meeting last week? And I didn't say if you thought it was racist, right? I owned it, but I also, could assume she knew why I was calling, that I had heard her feedback. And I had certainly not behaved in any way that would have indicated that she wouldn't be subjected to more of it, right? As soon as she sees me on the phone, I might be wanting to tell her why that wasn't racism at all. So that's why I'm making this point so you see how intentional and strategic my approach to her was. We got in the meeting, we talked about it, I listened, I owned, I acknowledged. And then at the end, I said, is there anything else that you need to hear or say that we might move forward? And by the way, I didn't go on about what I really meant or my intentions. Right. I just focused on how I impacted her. And I'll never forget, she said to me, yeah, if we're going to be working together, you will run your racism at me again. Mm. So the next time you do it, would you like your feedback publicly or privately? Mm. And I thought I loved it. I thought, what a radical thing to say to a white person. I'd like to think at that point, I had demonstrated that I could understand what she meant. And what she meant was, come on, you're a product of your society. If we're going to work together, stuff's going to come out. And so when it does, I'm being real generous and giving you the option. Do you want to hear about it in public or private? And I said, in my case, please, publicly.
Yes.
It's just so important that other white people see that I'm not outside of any of this and that I have the opportunity to model non-defensive reception. So that would be an example.
Thank you so much for that, Dr. D'Angelo. I remember the very first time a friend of mine said, Maggie, this was racist. You said this. And I had to try to process through the like mortification, because intuitively in the back of my head, I was like, this isn't about me. I mean, it is because I did it, but don't make this person comfort you because you showed up as a racist and perpetuated racism against this person. And it was like, had to move through it to try to control that. I lost my stuff later. But in that moment, I had to, I'm sorry. You can always tell me when that happens. Tell me how that made you feel, and let's have that conversation. I'm sorry. And I tried to listen as much as I could and not lose it, so that this person that I loved and cared for wasn't having to care for the racist in me. I mean, it was
right.
It's important and difficult. I want to talk about two more things. We've got a little bit of business to do. So we're going to close out this segment. We're going to come back. We're going to give you the resources. And then I want to share what brought me to tears the last time I heard Dr. D'Angelo speak. It was incredibly moving. And I hope it provides everyone else a foothold to explore the whiteness that is our society that we move through some images. I promise you, you won't want to miss it. My name is Maggie Dawn. My special guest this show, Dr. Robin D'Angelo, author of White Fragility and Nice Racism. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back in just a moment here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. We're having an in-depth conversation today about systemic racism and racism with, I can't imagine a better guest to help me unpack this, especially the white fragility part of it, none other than Dr. Robin D'Angelo, the woman who wrote the book of the same name, as well as Nice Racism, How Progressive White People Perpetuate Racial Harm, which came out in 2021. Dr. D'Angelo, we wanted to give people some resources, some access points, some, frankly, suggestions on what to do. Let me start with this question, because I'm always struggling with it and I just blunder through some of the conversations. When I bring up race or I'm having a discussion about racism and I get the really aggressive denialism and I get the anger and the fear and the deflection, how do I help move past that with someone? How do our listeners, if they want to engage in this work, how do you help people move past that moment of denial and anger?
Yeah. I mean, in a way, you set me up to, this is when we're on the receiving end, but we had just talked about when we get feedback. Yes. And let me just offer the risk it takes for, say, Black and brown people to tell us, you know, I've asked so many Black and brown people in my workshops, how often have you given a white person feedback on our inevitable racist behaviors and assumptions and had it go well for you? Mm. I mean, they laugh, they roll their eyes, never, maybe once. So they're taking a huge risk. And on some level, there's trust there. And I've just had countless Black people say to me, we're not going to give up on you when you show this. I mean, we know, you know, we live in the same society you live in, but what we're looking for is, where can we go from there?
Yeah.
And if we can't go there with you, that's when we don't trust you anymore. We may not have a relationship. So when there's a couple of it's all about strategy, right? You're asking me, what do I do when I, you know, I hear it or people are responding, is you do your best to think, what's the most strategic way to challenge this. Sometimes it's let's wait until emotions are down, especially if it's a family member or something. I'll hit it later when I myself am also not as, you know, I've had a chance to think about it. But I will often point the finger inward rather than outward. So, I mean, sometimes if somebody's straight up saying the N-word, you have to just say that's not acceptable. But most of the time, it's not quite that cut and dry. I just say, hey, you know, I try to bring the defensiveness down by saying, oh, I can relate. I've had that feeling too before. I recognize that feeling, or I recognize that thought. But you know, I've had the opportunity to, and then you kind of share something and it's really changed the way I think about that. And then you just speak for your own experience, right? I'm just telling you that this is how I see it now. It's very hard to argue with me because it's my experience. You had to hear a counter narrative for just a moment. And I really want to impart on white people is that you do that for yourself, not so much for them. If they shift as a result of that, that's wonderful. But you're healing your own socialization into it when you break with white solidarity. White solidarity is that unspoken agreement. Let's keep each other comfortable. Let's, you know,
be not nice. Rock the boat.
Yeah. When you break with that, then you're in your integrity. You're going to be able to sleep well that night. So think about it, doing it for you, not them, not to change them, but to change yourself. And actually, it kind of gives you more room to be nervous and inarticulate, but by God, you did it. And you'll get better at it, but you know, you started.
And a couple of resources or places that people can go, of course, and I'll say it for Dr. D'Angelo, you can pick up her books, White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. I've given out about 100 copies of it myself since it was published, as well as Nice Racism, How Progressive White People Perpetuate Racial Harm. It'll be on my holiday gift list for everyone this year as well. You can check those out. What are a couple of other resources for folks?
Well, Layla Saad, S-A-A-D, has a book called Me and White Supremacy Workbook. And I love it because it's a workbook. And so it really gets you, it talks you through exercises. It has you writing. And I love anything that's active and engaging. And she has some deep questions. It's really invokes insight. Now, Dr. Eddie Moore, he is the founder of the White Privilege Conference. I don't know if some people have heard of that, but it's an annual conference where people go to look at these issues. He has something called the 21-Day Challenge. And you can do it with a group. My daughter did it with her work team. Each day for 21 days, you do a small thing, and then you process it. And so again, notice how reading books is great, but these two things have you actively doing something. And then the last thing is I would recommend two organizations. One is called Surge, Standing Up for Racial Justice. They're actually doing a white women's march, and they're going to call, and then a white men's call. The other one is called Red Wine and Blue, W-I-N-E, Red Wine and Blue. And it was a group of suburban mothers that used to just, you know, get together for wine. And they basically said, you know what? They don't speak for us when they're burning those books. We want our children to read those books. And now they are a wonderful activist organization. So look them up and figure out how to get involved with Red Wine and Blue and Surge, Standing Up for Racial Justice.
We'll put those resources on the show page for today's show so you can all find them there. I wanted to close with talking about artist Harmonia Rosales. You shared one of her images called The Creation of God at the last time I heard you speak. And it basically is the very famous image of God touching Adam finger to finger on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, but recast with a powerful older black woman as God reaching to a empowered, beautiful black younger woman. It brought me to tears immediately. It is a visual representation of everything that we've been talking about. Tell us a bit about the image. And I want to briefly ask you this as well, a follow-up question. Misogynoir is very real. And we now know that Kamala Harris will be the Democratic nominee for president. What can we expect?
Whew. Okay. So you will notice that I think you used one time, sexism as a way in. And so that's what I would just say. We want to use it as a way in, but not as a way out. So in other words, white women don't have any less racism. We just manifest it differently. But we do have a way in, which is understanding sexism and drawing those parallels, not to say it's the same. So when there's a piece of racism I don't understand, I change the roles and imagine that a man is saying to me what I'm struggling with to say to, or I, you know what I mean? I change the roles in my mind and I usually can see it. So we're used to the misogyny that Hillary Clinton got, you know, that many women have gotten, but now it's going to be merged around Kamala with incredible racism. So misogynoir is the term for when sexism and misogyny come together with racism. I think we're going to see levels of it that are going to shock some white people, maybe not shock some black people. And so we really have to resist. Some of it might even be framed in ways that's compelling, because we've also had those ideas planted within us, and we just have to resist and stand up against it. But don't be naive about what's coming and what's already coming. And also be really thoughtful about how, I can't tell you how many of my black friends or people, black people on TikTok are just like, fasten your belt, because this is going to be gut-wrenchingly painful to watch. Yeah. So let's recognize that we're up against fascism here. Nobody's perfect. Kamala's not perfect. Don't let them divide us, right? They'll stand by. Look at their candidate. They'll stand by him no matter what he does. We have to stand by ours, and then we can worry about the imperfections once we get in the darn position to be even able to make decisions for our own selves.
That's my special guest, Dr. Robin DiAngelo. Thank you so very, very much. Expert author from the University of Washington. You can find her books, White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism, and Nice Racism, How Progressive White People Perpetuate Racial Harm. Thank you so much, Robin. I really, really appreciate it. That's going to do it for my interview with Robin DiAngelo, Dr. DiAngelo. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Final thoughts on this.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California, well, to the New
Welcome back, everybody, to the Maggie Dawn Show. I'm Brian Kelly, finishing out the half hour, last half hour here with you. We just listened to Maggie's interview with Robin DiAngelo, author of White Fragility. Wow, that was powerful. I remember recording that and going, and yes. I'm really happy that you guys got to hear that. If you want to hear it again, check out the podcast at civicmedia.us. Click on the Maggie Dawn Show. You can get it right to you. If you want to react to that interview, which I think was pretty darn awesome, I had a couple of friends text me saying that they were in tears listening to it. Just the what it brings out in people, and how, you know, you realize that you are a racist and not necessarily bad, evil person racist, but it's about power. It's about, you know, taking advantage of what you already are, like it's what you already have. So I want to hear your comments. I want to hear your concerns. I want to hear everything that you have to say about that. Give me a call, 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. Jess is over there.
Hey, so, yeah.
She's pretty awesome and nice, and she will, and nice in a genuine way, not nice in the way that we talked about niceness in White Fragility. I really like that analogy. She made the analogy of niceness being like, niceness is you pass by someone on the side of the road with a flat tire, and you drive by slower, and you wave at them and say, "I hope you work out fine," and then next thing you know, but that's it. That's being nice. But then you actually helping them is really what you need to do. So, I really like that analogy. We have a caller on the line. I don't know if you're familiar with this. I think this is a first time caller. His name is Earl from Milwaukee. Earl, you're on the line. How you doing?
I'm doing fine, Brian. I have to say to you that listening to that, you really made me stop and think. And as a 70-year-old black man, the fact that this kind of conversation can be had by Maggie is what is needed. I think that people don't realize the impact of this on people, especially young people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, experiencing this my entire life. And so people don't realize it. I found that out in many instances. They don't realize it. And so maybe this is, I guess, the opening that is necessary to try to fix this, because it has to be fixed.
Yes.
And I think people don't realize the damage that they do to other human beings. And it rolls off, you know, so easily, because when you live in a society like ours, and when you live in a state like Wisconsin that only makes up 5% of it is black, there are people in this entire state who never get to see a black person.
Yep.
But yet their judgment, which tears to rivets people of color, is what's so egregious. And it is great to hear the subject and the conversation, man. I couldn't help during the whole conversation to say, yes, yes.
Yeah.
How can we get more people to understand this, to hear this?
Yeah.
But really, that's my sermon.
Please, anytime you want, Earl. I mean, you've been talking about this for a while, and I've been wanting to have this conversation. But again, I lack the tools to be able to speak about it. I mean, our buddy Al called me last week, right? Jess and I were doing the show about culture. We were talking about U.S. culture, and you know, going through all the facets of U.S. culture in a kind of broader sense, and how it's important and why culture is extremely important. And I completely glossed over the entire, because I don't have the experience. But luckily, Al called and said, hey, by the way, culture was used as a weapon when people were brought over here as slaves. They were stripped of their culture, stripped of all their gods, and replaced with what we wanted them to be. And I completely glossed that over, and thank goodness our friend Al called and added that perspective, because I was ready to just go, la-di-da-di-da, it's totally fine. And it wasn't. So I feel really great that I learned something, and that hopefully everybody else did as well. You know, it's important that it's not just, you know, people with crazy Southern accents screaming the N-word. It's people like you and, you know, myself and Jess, too.
Well, you know, Brian, the worst part about all of it is that I think when people say that's over, that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Why are you using that as a crutch? Why are you using that as an excuse? That more than anything else is the thing that burns me.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are people who say we're not a racist nation. That doesn't exist. Why can't you people just, you know, do the right thing? And it's not that easy. But that conversation was worth $1 million, man. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, and thank you for calling in. I'm really happy that you were listening, man.
All right.
I love your perspective. Yes, anytime. Thank you, Earl. That's Earl Ingram. Check him out every morning on the Civic Media Radio Network from 8 to 10. Earl got the presidential conversation. He got that guy. When I was at Biden speaking, right, when Biden came to town at the Black Chamber of Commerce, I'm sitting back there at Radio Row, and I got there early, so we got the like front row and everything. But it's behind all the cameras and stuff, right? So when they were loading in everybody and bringing all the VIPs in, they brought the VIPs basically right in front of us behind the cameras, and they looped around into the VIP section to listen to the president. And that entire VIP section of Milwaukee basically just was a lineup to just fist bump Earl the whole way through.
As it should be.
It's just awesome. So check him out every morning on the Civic Media Radio Network, 8 to 10. I have a couple examples where this past week I just looked at it and went, that's what Robin talked about. That right there was what Robin talked about. But I'm going to get into those examples, but I also want to hear your thoughts on the Robin DiAngelo interview with Maggie Dawn. 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. I'm being told that Vice President Kamala Harris has chosen her nominee. That nominee has accepted her running mate. We don't know who it is, but I do know that it is down to two people that I'm told. It's down to Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz. That's reported by Reuters. So it's one of those two, according to Reuters, which will be really interesting. She's going to make the first appearance, I believe. She's going to announce it by tomorrow, she said. And I believe her making first appearance at Temple in Philadelphia. So either it might be Shapiro because she's at Temple, but I think her schedule was going to be in Philadelphia either way.
Either way, it's going to be.
If we do have that breaking news, we will take it live, and we'll be joined by potentially Todd Alba as well. So keep it tuned into this Pacific Media Radio Network. We will have breaking news as soon as we know. We will let you know. But according to Reuters, it is down to two people: Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz. And so she's chosen, and that person knows. We just don't know who it is yet. So we're just waiting around to see if she's going to call us, because I think she will, for sure. Because she calls, she consults with us. Well, basically, she talks to us through Beyonce, because she called Beyonce to say, hey, can I use your, or Beyonce called her to say it was okay, but Beyonce called us to see if it was okay, since we used the Freedom song from Beyonce first. Beyonce called us and said, hey, I'm going to let VP Harris use it. And we were like, totally cool.
Well, yeah, it was more important to clear it with us first.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we did use it first. So
yeah,
important with that. So she's definitely going to call us, or Beyonce may call. Either way, Vice President Harris or Beyonce will definitely call this station at 855-75-CIVIC. And maybe they'll have a comment or two about the Robin DiAngelo interview, White Fragility. That is the book that she had authored. So let's go to Cam from Appleton, formerly of Nina. Cam is in Appleton now, right? How you doing, Cam?
I'm in Appleton, yeah. Nina stuff fell out. It's a long story. Basically, don't get a landlord that traps you inside of your home with hornets.
Oh, that's important. As long as it's not a timeshare, because then you'd be a client. I like the way the guy says client. If I take you as a client, just... Really weird. Anyway, sorry to interrupt there.
A gentleman named Quant. when I hear these discussions growing up, I've heard it a ton growing up, I think, because a lot of teaching has become a little bit more progressive over time and more accepting. And when I heard these, the only time that I would hear the part that I've always wanted to hear publicly was only at home between me and my mom. And my mom is white. I'm very, very white. But my mom grew up in Compton.
Oh, okay.
And she would tell me that, this is legitimate. She wasn't exaggerating at all. When she grew up in Compton, she would be left alone completely when it came to any of the alleged violence and gang stuff that happened down over there. And she had plenty of African-American friends over there. And they left her alone, and she asked why she never seemed to get bothered when the news is saying all this stuff all the time. And she was told that they honestly thought that the feds planted her there.
Wow.
And that kind of hit home that she's not being treated like the others just because of that. It ain't a great feeling. But when we would talk about this, she would try to point out to me, hey, you know, like some people will point out that these African-American folks, if they think that they're, and it's not all of them, I feel bad even like saying it the way that I am, because I don't know how to articulate it very well. But if you see someone that has like the flashy nails, the cell phones, and they're using EBT, and I see people try to really, really encapsulate that into some racist stereotype. And she would really drive home the point with me. These people are going through their own struggles day to day. Of course, they're going to make bad financial decisions. Everyone does when they're not feeling great and when they're not in a great position to, in order to bring some amount of like pressure away from their lives and give them some level of happiness. And I don't fault anyone for that. I wish that stuff like that would be challenged a little bit more when these conversations get had. Not that it's a criticism on civic media or you guys. It's just, I really wish it could be homed in on, because when people have a specific example, they are able to apply it a lot better, because general words just don't work that way for a lot of people.
Yep. Cam, you hit the nail right on the head, and you pretty much said exactly what we were talking about all last Friday. Man, that's exactly what the point is. What do you think of when you think of somebody who's using food stamps? What's the first picture you have in your head? What's the first picture you have in your head when you think of somebody who runs a company, who's a business owner? What picture do you have in your head of someone who works hard? What are the pictures that you have in your mind of what that is? Let's put aside the fact that, you know, people who use food stamps need them. I know some people who are representatives of this in this state who have used that stuff. You don't know what people are going through, and that's the whole point. And it's having the humility to know that you're the person who's thinking about that, who knows that you have that feeling inside of you, that you have those instant thoughts about what that is. Come back with us, 855-75-CIVIC. Give me a call. We're going to talk about white fragility. We're going to talk about the vice presidential pick if it comes in. And we'll be back, 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. It's happening. The Maggie Dawn Show continues on the Civic Media Radio Network. So the first couple segments of this entire show, the last couple hours, we've been listening to Maggie interview Robin DiAngelo, the author of White Fragility. I found the entire interview fascinating and telling and eye-opening. The idea that I myself am a racist because I benefit from a racist society and from a racist system. Acknowledging that is very freeing, because it all opens up the ability to learn about things. It's fantastic. I'd say this in terms of, not that it's great that racist things happen, or not that it's great that I do them, but it's the idea that I'm open to the ability to know that I am, to know that I benefit from it, because it's a system of power. It's about power. It's about who has the power and who benefits from that. And so thinking of this interview, I've been watching over this past week, and a couple things popped out of like, wow. That's exactly what she just said. First, most blatant, obvious example is Trump at the NABJs. Donald Trump was confronted with the things he actually said and asked about why people would want to vote for him after he said the exact things that Rachel Scott politely brought up to him. After saying, hey, thank you for your time and thank you for being here, we know it's hard for you to do so. And he responded with anger, and more anger.
And also a little bit of anger.
And a little bit of anger, and a little bit more racism. And he leaned into it more.
He's doubled down on it since.
Yes. We don't want to rehash that whole thing, but it's textbook white fragility. It's exactly what they were just talking about for the last hour and a half. Like, it couldn't be any more obvious. I also watch Big Brother. Do you watch Big Brother?
I do not.
I am a Big Brother fanatic. At some point, I may even try and be on that show. It's fun. I think it's amazing. And it's I hate watched it. Like 10, 15 years ago. I think maybe 15 years ago. I was starting to, yeah, it was Amy and I were getting together. And I'm like, well, I want to hang out with her, but I know that every week, three times a week now, she's going to watch this show. And she's not going to be able to talk to me about it. So I'm going to have to talk. I'm either going to have to completely ignore this entire part of her life for a summer, or I can hate watch it and maybe get her to realize how stupid it is and watch something else instead.
Well, you accomplished half of that.
She completely got me addicted. I am a huge fan of Big Brother.
Well, you were able to admit that you were wrong.
Well, yeah.
And move on to a place of growth.
Yes,
isn't
exactly.
Isn't that wonderful?
Exactly. Humility is an amazing thing, folks. Mostly because I read the Greek tragedies and I know about hubris.
Oh, yeah. It's a bad thing.
Hubris is bad.
Every time.
Every time.
Every time.
Oh, man. What happened? Oh, hubris in my face again. Yeah. So getting back to Big Brother, right? So the last couple of seasons, they've had some racist issues, let's just say. Maybe going five seasons back or so. Where they ended up getting more... Basically, they'd have one, maybe two people of color, and then they'd get kind of hung around, but basically socially completely left out of everything. Then they had a season with a lawyer from Milwaukee, Xavier, who actually won. But they had an alliance called the Cookout, which was basically all the black people in the house. And it was half the house, and they basically worked together to get everyone else out, like the show does, in an alliance type of thing. But then again, that was blatantly like completely put together by ABC. So it's, you know, and good. And I was totally all about it. I was really happy for it. But it's also like very ham-handed and just not cool. So the last couple seasons, they've kind of like balanced things out, and there's a little bit more. Last year, there was a Sick contestant who won, and he talked about Sikhism and how great that is. By the way, where I live, Oak Creek has a really awesome Sikh population, and they give out water on July 4th, and boy, do I love them. Anyway, I've never met a Sikh person I didn't like. So they're getting more, you know, diverse and stuff, right? So this season, there's a crazy lady. She's just nuts. Her name's Angela. She's a mom, and she just has not assimilated to any other life. She's from Utah, and she just is paranoid. The game makes you go paranoid. You kind of go, like, 2 weeks is basically what I give everyone to lose their mind and then be themselves in front of a camera, because it takes that long to assimilate and kind of figure out what it's like to be on a show 24/7, right? So she flips out and has like a meltdown. She's already a target and kind of a nutso job. So this person she's working with that doesn't want to work with her, but she's working with anyway, goes up. She points out the four people of color outside who are talking and says, "That's the group. That's the group," right? And that doesn't look good.
No.
But In the context of the game, she was really just saying those people are working. They actually were talking about working together. And she's like, I think they're working together. And she wasn't saying whether she wanted to or not. Point is that it looked bad. So when one of the people of color found out about it and said, hey, when you point that out, it doesn't look good. Wasn't accusing her of anything, just saying, hey, when national television sees you do that, it does not look good. She did textbook white fragility. I have so many friends. And just did like everything textbook. She flipped out and she went to every person of color in the house and goes, I would never. I love you. Like it was just
That's rough.
Nuts. So she flipped out, obviously, white fragility all over the place. She gets pulled to the diary room. And the next scene, right afterwards, obviously, this is cut. There's 24 hours a day and they only have 1 hour to show the show. But she comes back, and there clearly was a person back there who coached her, because she goes, hey, I didn't listen to what you had to say in your perspective, basically quoting almost verbatim Robin DiAngelo. And I guarantee you they have someone in there that coached her to come out and say, it was great. It was awesome. Like, she made a really good apology and really, really cool. But, yeah.
Well, hey, that's a way to model it.
Pretty much. It's in pop culture. It's in nowadays, and it's actually working. And it turns out that the show is much better. She's still in the house. Anyway, watch Big Brother. Keep up with the Maggie Dawn Show. We'll be back tomorrow and give us a call. Tomorrow we're going to talk about the VP pick because probably they're going to be having one. All right. Thank you very much, Maggie Dawn Show. I'll stand up for you. Will you stand up for me? On the Civic Media Radio Network.